content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jen Rogers from the Triangle Radio Reading Service. For the next half hour, I shall be reading to you from Smithsonian Magazine, the magazine of the Smithsonian Institute. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. On today's program, we'll continue reading from the December 2018 issue of Smithsonian Magazine, which is their annual spotlight on the Genius of America, the 2018 American Ingenuity Awards. We'll start with an article titled Seeing the Light by Jocelyn Kaiser. A wife and husband research team cracks the code on gene therapy with a new treatment for blindness. 3 months after Misty Lovelace was born, she was already going blind. In first grade, she could still read small print, but within a few years, her school books were binders of large print pages. To navigate hallways, she memorized the route or depended on a teacher or friend. Her sight was like having really dark sunglasses and looking through a tunnel, she recalls. In fifth grade, someone brought in a mobile planetarium to show the students lights representing the stars. Misty pretended she could see them. When she was 12, doctors determined that Misty's blindness had a genetic cause called Leber congenital amaurosis, LCA. Fortunately, a husband and wife team at the University of Pennsylvania, Jean Bennett and Albert McGuire, were testing a potential cure, and Misty traveled from Kentucky to take part in the study. A day after the surgery, doctors took off her eye patch. "I saw a burst of color. Everything was so much brighter," she recalls. For the first time in years, she could clearly see her mother's face, her grandmother's wrinkles, the fabric seams in her stuffed animals. At home in the backyard pool one night, she looked up and started screaming. "I see these little lights and they're all blinking. I started to freak," she recalls. Her mother rushed out, thinking chlorine was hurting her daughter's treated eye. Misty could finally see the stars. Misty's treatment became available to the public during the past year under the name Luxturna. Its FDA approval in December 2017 was huge news, not only for the 1,000 to 2,000 Americans with Misty's type of LCA, but for people with other genetic diseases that could one day be cured through gene therapy. "I'd last visited Bennett and McGuire 10 years ago when they were treating their first patients. This past July, they reflected on their journey while brunching on their patio in the Philadelphia suburb of Bryn Mawr. Mercury, a brown and black briar dog, panted in the heat. Born blind, he was one of the couple's earliest research subjects. His mother, Venus, another formerly blind dog, was staying cool indoors. There were innumerable obstacles along the way," said Bennett, 63, curled up in a chair with her coffee. McGuire, 58, handed me a jar of honey from his beehives. He told me his wife deserved credit for frequently staying up working while he was snoring in bed. The two met and married at Harvard Medical School. McGuire was becoming an eye surgeon, and Bennett, who also had a PhD in developmental biology, was about to enter the new field of gene therapy. Working together, the pair showed that they could improve the vision of mice born with genetic blindness. In 2000, they tested this on Briar dogs who had been born with defective copies of RPE65, the gene affected by LCA. RPE65 is crucial for the visual cycle in mammals. When light hits sensitive pigments in the retina, it launches a series of reactions that make sight possible. Everyone has brief moments when this process falters. For instance, after the eye is overwhelmed by a camera flash. In healthy eyes, these moments are fleeting. But people who have two defective copies of RPE65 don't react to light properly. Over time, the light-sensing cells, the rods and cones, die off, causing their vision to disappear. Working with the dogs, the scientists modified an adeno-associated virus, a small virus that's harmless to mammals, so it carried DNA with normal RPE65. Then they injected the virus into one eye of each blind puppy. Within days, the frightened dogs who bumped into objects had turned into active sighted animals. By 2007, it was time to try the procedure on people. The medical community was still reeling from the 1999 death of teenager Jesse Gelsinger in an unrelated gene therapy study at Penn. Starting this new research was risky. But Gelsinger had been treated for a metabolic liver disease, and the eye had certain advantages. It was easy to access, and only a small area of tissue, not the entire organ, needed to receive the gene. Plus, doctors could try the therapy in one eye before moving on to the second. They didn't expect an issue with patients making antibodies to the virus, since the eyes are largely shielded from the body's immune response. McGuire and Bennett, together with the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, CHOP, began testing a low dose of this treatment in three young adults with RPE65 mutations. McGuire injected a pea-sized drop under their retinas, containing billions of RPE65-carrying viruses. The patient's vision improved. They could read signs and see patterns in rugs, and they could read more lines on an eye chart. One Saturday at home, Bennett was looking at data on a patient's pupil contraction and raced upstairs to awaken McGuire from a nap. "We were thrilled," she says. From there, the team showed that they could successfully treat the patient's second eyes. The next step was to seek FDA approval. In 2013, the team founded Spark Therapeutics, a biotech firm, to develop and fund a larger trial at CHOP in the University of Iowa and carry out other work to get the first U.S. approval for the virus-delivered treatment for a genetic disease. "There was no roadmap, and this was a very heavy lift," says Catherine High, a hematologist and gene therapy researcher who helped lead the trials at CHOP and went on to become president of Spark. Several children have now received Luxturna as part of their clinical care. The treatment is $850,000 for both eyes. "The cost horrifies me personally," admits Bennett. Neither she nor McGuire profits financially from the therapy. High says the price is steep because the current system is not designed for one-time high-value treatments. She notes that drugs for a condition like hemophilia cost as much as $400,000 a year over an entire lifetime. "One would hope the system would reward therapies that achieve their effects through a single treatment, but that is not yet the case," High says. It's unknown how long Luxturna's benefits will last, but McGuire says patients treated up to 11 years ago still have stable vision in the second eye, which received a higher dose than the first. Many of them can walk now without a cane and tell colors apart. Those on the younger end of the 4 to 44-year-old range report that the most benefits, since they've lost fewer photoreceptor cells. Kids who couldn't play outdoors after dark or ride a bike without help are now able to do those things. Some of the teenagers are eligible for driver's licenses. They're able to play varsity soccer and join the cheerleading squad. Their social lives blossomed once they could read friends' faces. The couple accomplished all this while raising three children, now grown. Their house is still decorated with the kids' art, along with McGuire's paintings of cows. Their oldest child, Sarah McGuire, is 32 and a postdoctoral researcher at Johns Hopkins, where she's tweaking the genes of mosquitoes to make them dislike the smell of humans. She recalls a fairly normal childhood despite having really quirky parents. "My dad would come home and start dancing with a dog like Pee Wee Herman," she says. When she brought insect research home on a visit last year, Bennett eagerly equipped a bathroom with a humidifier and heater to keep the bugs alive. One of these days, Bennett and McGuire hope to retire and raise cows, sheep, or crops. "Berkshire Bud," McGuire jokes. For now, they're hard at work at the Center for Advanced Retinal and Ocular Therapeutics, or CARET, which Bennett founded at Penn in 2014. "When I visited, researchers were making gene-carrying viruses for new trials. The excitement was palpable. Luxturna has paved the way for the FDA to approve a multitude of promising treatments, not just for the eye, but for other organs and diseases being studied elsewhere." "There was no path before," says Bennett, "and now there is." Misty Lovelace is now 19, and her vision is about 20/64 with glasses. "When the sun is shining," she says, "I can do anything." She hopes to soon start her own business training horses. "I can't believe it was me," she says, looking back at her role in Bennett and McGuire's study. "It's just wow, like hitting the lottery. They did it. They opened the doors for everybody." Next, we'll move on to the award in performing arts for Janelle Monae, Dirty Computer. "The Soul of the New Machine" by Brittany Spanos. A musical virtuoso leaves her old persona behind and emerges as America's most revolutionary artist. Every generation deserves an artist like Janelle Monae, an out-of-the-box creative who challenges both the mainstream and the underground to keep up with her futuristic vision. With her third album, Dirty Computer, released in April, Monet realized that the person she needed to challenge most was herself. The sprawling, pop-leaning epic that features appearances from Friends, Zoe Kravitz, Grimes, Heroes, Brian Wilson, John Bryan, and heroes she can now call friends, Stevie Wonder, signaled the first time Monet would fully shed the skin of the fictional Cindy Mayweather, the android persona whose story is explored in her previous two albums and debut EP. Now it was time to meet Monet, imperfections and all. "I was really afraid for anybody to see me not at the top of my game," she told me back in April, when I visited her Atlanta-based headquarters. She was anxious about the release of Dirty Computer, worried how people would receive her story as opposed to Mayweather's. "But I'm at a space where my vulnerabilities and my honesty have become cooler to me," she continued. That honesty meant opening up to her fans in the world as a queer black woman in America. "I think for a while I was trying to clean myself, trying to make myself appear perfect. But now, I respect the dirt. It's about the dirt and not getting rid of it." Janelle Monae Robinson grew up in a working-class family in Kansas City, Kansas, singing in church and later pursuing musical theater, first in high school and later during a brief stint at college in Manhattan. But New York City began to feel like the wrong place to start, so she relocated to Atlanta, where she worked at Office Depot and sang on college campuses. Her industriousness led to connections to her creative soulmates Nate Rocket Wonder and Chuck Lightning, who perform as the funk duo Deep Cotton, and Big Boy of the hip-hop duo Outkast, who brought her to Sean Diddy Combs and Bad Boy Records. She made her debut in 2007 with Metropolis, Suite 1, The Chase, a genre-jumping EP that caught Prince's ear. He became a mentor and got her a Grammy nomination for the song Many Moons. Her fusion of rock, funk, hip-hop, and R&B proved timely, even ahead of the curve. Her first LP, The Arch Android, followed in 2010, building up to 2013's The Electric Lady, an elaborate opus that gave a taste of what she could do without Mayweather's tail as her album spine. Monet started thinking along the lines of Dirty Computer even before she released The Arch Android. The concept came out of her pivotal therapy sessions, which helped her identify the ways she internalized the parts of herself she was afraid of. Accepting her dirt has helped many others do the same. "It leaves me speechless whenever I see people writing a line about how the music has helped them come out to their family, has helped them not feel so alone, has helped them find courage to walk in their truth," she said when we spoke in October. "All of those things just make me very humbled." Monet has spent months taking Dirty Computer on tour, bringing to life the nearly hour-long video or a motion picture that threads together the album's song and stars Monet and her friend Tessa Thompson as radicals in an oppressive futuristic society who are detained and cleaned. The concerts reflect the thrillingly free world Monet and Thompson's characters inhabit before running afoul of the authorities. "Although this is personal work, it's not solely about me. It's about us," she says, referring to both the music and its performance. "Community was one of the words I kept in my heart the entire time I was making the project. I'm creating this space for other Dirty Computers like myself to feel loved, to feel heard, to feel seen, to feel celebrated." This yearning undergirds all of Monet's work. She took notable roles in two of 2016's most lauded films. In Hidden Figures, she played the groundbreaking NASA engineer Mary Jackson. And in Moonlight, she played Teresa, the woman who provides a safe space for the young protagonist, Chiron, as he comes to terms with his homosexuality and escapes a volatile home life. This month, she'll appear in Welcome to Marwen, beside Steve Carell. She plays G.I. Julie, whom Carell's character befriends as he recovers from a violent assault. "I connect with these women who are strong and uplifting, and they don't get the love and respect that I feel like they deserve in real life," she says. "I feel a personal responsibility to honor them whenever I can." Her work also extends offstage. Before Time's Up, which she proudly participates in, was founded, she established Femme the Future to empower women in the entertainment industry. She partnered with Belvedere Vodka to launch A Beautiful Future, which helped produce short films written and directed by women to answer the question, "What does a beautiful future look like to you?" It's the same question Cindy Mayweather aspired to answer as she fought for her right as an android to love a human. It's the same question Monet aspires to answer on Dirty Computer. "A beautiful future," she said, "looks like one of inclusion for me." Next, we'll move on to visual arts. John Krasinski, A Quiet Place. Genius at Work, by J.W. Bishop. An actor-turned-director creates a genre-busting horror movie with a terrifying twist. Silence. Last March, John Krasinski and his wife, Emily Blunt, were driving to the world premiere of their first collaboration, A Quiet Place, at the South by Southwest Film Festival in Austin, Texas. Nearly 20 years into his career, Krasinski had directed other features, brief interviews with Hideous Men, The Hollers, and his own acting opposite formidable co-stars. But he'd never been so nervous, so Blunt suggested that he focus on a single expectation for the screening. Sitting in the car, he thought, if people clapped, that would be really cool. Krasinski, now 39, seems modest by nature and nurture. He was raised in a Boston suburb by loving parents, his father a doctor and his mother a nurse, who reinforced family values and how can I help attitude in him and his two brothers, both older. He still wonders whether he deserved what he calls his lottery ticket breakout role as paper salesman Jim Halpert on the American version of The Office, which he landed after studying playwriting and English literature at Brown University and working his way through small movie roles. Still, he had a good reason to be anxious at the screening. With A Quiet Place, he made a horror movie for grown-ups, exploding the genre by eschewing gore, deploying silence as an instrument of suspense, and focusing on familial love. The script, by Brian Woods and Scott Beck, came over Krasinski's transom shortly after Blunt gave birth to their younger daughter, Violet. Their firstborn, Hazel, was two at the time. Like so many new parents, Krasinski was terrified that he might not be able to protect his children, and he saw the potential for a horror story anchored in this primal fear. He revised the script to amplify the plight of the family trying to survive in a world where alien creatures with heightened hearing attack at the slightest sound. Tagline, if they hear you, they hunt you. Krasinski would also play the father. He and Blunt, who married in 2010, had been cautious about collaborating professionally. But when Blunt, a Golden Globe-winning actress, read the script, she said, I had this overwhelming feeling of, I don't want anybody else to play this part. For the first time, I wanted to put my whole self into the movie, Krasinski told me. He studied horror films, noting every single music cue, tension, beat, or jump scare that worked on me. He noticed the ways There Will Be Blood and No Country for Old Men went quiet in certain scenes. There was a power to that, a confidence that I wanted to put in our movie. Confidence indeed. His script for A Quiet Place, a film that runs 90 minutes, has only about 90 lines of dialogue. In the pervading silences, the family communicates almost entirely in sign language and by facial expression. Sound effects are sparse, the few bursts of dialogue precise. Krasinski went all in on the production details. He scoured Zillow to find the perfect farmhouse in upstate New York. He dressed the house with private photographs of himself, Blunt, and their real-life children. Recalling a junior high lesson about medieval villagers lighting fires down a coastline to warn against incoming threats, he directed his crew to string lights across the property to simulate the primitive alert system. He even stood in for the aliens on the set before they were added digitally in post-production, to help Blunt and Noah Jupe and Millicent Simmons, who play his children, react authentically to them. The result is a highly personal, out-of-the-box horror film steeped in intimate human relationships. When A Quiet Place premiered before some 1,200 strangers in Austin, Krasinski recalls what happened with no little irony. People stood up and made the craziest noise. He says, I'll never forget it because I looked at my wife and she was yelling, Oh my God! But I couldn't hear because the cheering was so loud. I burst into tears and gave her a hug. The film has received nearly universal critical acclaim, but what has moved its director the most, he says, is the response from moviegoers, who raved about it online as they drove the box office gross to more than $300 million, a staggering number for a film that cost only $17 million to make. These fans have been so unbelievably kind and invested, he says. Since The Office ended in 2013, Krasinski has worked in overdrive. He executive produced Manchester by the Sea, 2016, which earned two Oscars and the Emmy-nominated competition series Lip Sync Battle, which he co-created. He currently stars in and executive produces Amazon's political thriller Tom Clancy's Jack Ryan. Blunt has the title role in Mary Poppins Returns to be released later this month. Working so feverishly, he says, makes him feel that I somewhat half deserve his Hollywood career. Now, between filming the second season of Jack Ryan and spending time with his family in Brooklyn, he's writing the sequel to A Quiet Place. Though he declines to provide details, Krasinski promises that the follow-up will be respectful of the response the original received. Making it, he says, isn't a business decision. It's a life decision. Now we'll move on to the Technology Award for Dmitry Dolgov and John Krafcik for Waymo. Taking It to the Streets by Tom Vanderbilt. Hop in, your driverless car is already here, thanks to the visionary engineers behind a bold experiment. As our Chrysler Pacifica minivan readies to make a left turn through a four-way intersection in Mountain View, California, it suddenly pauses. Across the intersection, a pickup truck creeps forward with ambiguous intent. Will it proceed? Make a right turn? Is the driver lost? Finally, the truck drifts toward the curb and comes to a stop. The hazard lights begin to blink. The Pacifica makes the turn. Our Pacifica drives deliberately, cautiously, following the law to the letter. It drives the way you yourself probably did during your driver's license exam. In the back seat, Dmitry Dolgov, Waymo's chief technology officer and VP of engineering, an intense man of 40 whose speech bears a faint trace of his native Russia, looks perfectly calm. Waymo's self-driving cars, after all, have now navigated some 10 million miles in 25 cities, which is extraordinary, considering how murky the world of traffic can be. Dolgov, whose own Waymo car ferried him to work today, as it does most days, has been with the company from the beginning, back when it was known as Google's self-driving car project. 2 years ago, Google spun Waymo out into an independent company dedicated to developing and commercializing self-driving technology, though it hasn't strayed from its roots. Still shares its Mountain View headquarters with X, Google's moonshot factory, and it has been the industry leader ever since it grew out of Stanford's university experimental vehicle named Junior, which took second place in the DARPA's 2007 Urban Challenge. That race was legendary for how disastrously the primitive autonomous vehicles of the country's leading roboticists traversed the Mojave Desert. Back then, simple geometric reasoning, being able to stay in a lane, was a massive achievement. Dolgov, then a postdoctoral fellow at Stanford, was a member of Junior's team. The time since, Waymo's cars have benefited from huge increases in onboard computing power and a sophisticated proprietary suite of sensors, radar, multiple cameras, three types of custom-lit LiDAR, most of which Waymo, now a subsidiary of Alphabet, Google's parent company, built itself. This comprehensive vision and sensing system allows Waymo to see 360 degrees at all times. Dolgov says one area he points out, twisting his neck over his shoulder, where Waymo cars have a clear advantage over humans. Last year, Waymo added a high-resolution, long-range sensor that, he said, can pick out a football helmet two football fields away, plus a short-range vision system to allow for uninterrupted surround viewing, down, behind, and next to the vehicle at all times. And rather than simply outfitting old-fashioned cars with a hardware stack, as Waymo used to do, the technology is increasingly integrated on the assembly line with its host vehicles, mostly Chrysler Pacific minivans, and soon tens of thousands of Jaguar I-PACE electric SUVs that will be added to the company's fleet in the coming years. But the software side is where the biggest gains have been made, as Google's advances in so-called deep learning have allowed self-driving technology to take a huge leap. Instead of trying to algorithmically encode every single instance of what might happen in the driving environment with a near-infinite litany of if-then rules, Waymo can now generalize what these rules should be, as Dolgov puts it. He says this change has improved the company's pedestrian detection ability by a factor of 100. Google is among the best, if not the best, at complex software development, says Brian Reimer, an autonomous vehicle researcher and director at MIT's New England University Transportation Center. By making use of Google's AI prowess, he goes on, Waymo is far and away the leader in the automated vehicle space. And so, a decade from its start as a moonshot experimental tech project, with limited test runs on carefully chosen routes in sunny, wide-avenued cities across the country, Waymo's fleet of 600 self-driving cars is now ready for prime time. Last year in Phoenix, a 400-strong test pool of early riders, pioneers, Waymo CEO John Krafcik calls them, signed up to beta test a ride-hailing taxi service. They have been getting free trips around a chunk of the city since. Before long, Waymo even began removing safety drivers for some of the cars, the first company to go truly driverless on public streets. And the Phoenix area service will soon go public, making it the world's first autonomous vehicle commercial taxi service, which riders will hail via an Uber-like app, launching by the end of the year. Still, as one might expect from a fleet of student drivers loosed up on the roads, there have been some bumps. In May, a Waymo minivan was involved in a collision in Phoenix when a car driving in the opposite direction swerved into its lane. There were no major injuries, and police concluded that Waymo's vehicle was not at fault. This past summer, the tech-focused news site The Information reported anecdotal complaints from area drivers about Waymo vehicles' sudden moves or stops, and noted that the self-driven car sometimes had trouble making unprotected turns, i.e. when the driver doesn't have a dedicated left turn arrow and has to decide when it's safe to turn. Of course, people tend to find fault with other drivers. As George Carlin quipped, anyone driving slower than him was an idiot, anyone faster a maniac. And making unprotected left turns is, statistically, among the greatest driving hazards for human drivers. We humans can be good drivers when we are focused, Krafchik says. But because we are human, we are not often focused. Despite having a century to get better at driving, we seem stuck in neutral, if not reverse. See, texting while driving. Yet we've come to accept a reality in which tens of thousands of people are killed on the roads each year, and many thousands more people seriously injured. Waymo's vision is one in which every single crash is methodically pored over the way regulators study airline crashes, precisely because they have become so rare. The vision was what convinced Krafchik to come to Waymo after spending the bulk of his career in traditional automobile industry, where he worked to advance technologies like anti-lock brakes and electronic stability control. The hardware has never been safer. The problem isn't the software. Krafchik notes that the Phoenix program isn't only about refining the complex technical dynamics of navigating self-driving cars to the city. It's also the first real-world experiment involving the subtle social etiquette of driving, the sort of evades computer logic. What should a car do, for instance, if it arrives at its destination but the passenger has fallen asleep? Rides now end with a bell chime. Or says a passenger takes a Waymo taxi to the grocery store. Drop-off point is in front of the store. Krafchik says, but where should pickup be? Shoppers loading groceries into Waymo cars were getting in the way of shoppers who were just arriving. A rider said, the service is great, but could you perhaps pick me up closer to the grocery cart return area so I'm not so close to traffic flow? Beyond driverless cars themselves, Waymo may even be a boon to public transportation. For instance, a last-mile solution in which passengers can be ferried to a transit hub without the worry of driving or parking. In July, Waymo and the Phoenix Area Transit Authority announced a pilot program to allow transit workers, and in time, seniors and disabled, to hail Waymo cars from their homes to light rail stations and back. There's just one thing Waymo will not be doing, Krafchik says, creating its own vehicles. Its sole effort, the Firefly, a prototype two-seater without a steering wheel or pedals, unveiled in 2015 and now retired, is displayed in the lobby at Waymo's headquarters. We're not building cars, Krafchik says. We're building the driver. We've run out of time for today's episode of Smithsonian Magazine. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jen Rogers, reading for the Triangle Radio Reading Service. Today's programming is underwritten with the generous support of Carl and Pat Keppen. We wish to thank them for their support. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The content this broadcast is readily available as a podcast after the broadcast at our website, trianglereadingservice.org. So long until next time. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138.